welcome to Ghostbusters, the radio show that talks about strange things in the neighborhood and weird stuff that don't look good. Talk about stuff that's messing with your head and crazy stuff that's happening in the bed. Why? Because many church folks are falling in the darkness. Bible calls us to walk as children of light. The Bible says, see then that you walk circumspectly, not as fools, but as wise, redeeming the time, because the days are evil. Welcome, 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 ladies and gentlemen, the Ghostbusters, the radio show that talks about strange things in the neighborhood and weird stuff that don't look good. Ladies and gentlemen, on yesterday, we was listening to a speaker, and he was talking about cultural Marxism. But he made a statement right close to the end that he started speaking out and writing blogs and things like that back in 2007, 2008, when the election and the campaign of Barack Obama, and he made mention that he thought that Barack Obama was one of the most dangerous men in America because of his stand on cultural Marxism and how he was raised, not so much raised, but how he attended Dr. Jeremiah Wright Church, a man who taught cultural Marxism there, was all in his sermons and what have you. And so he didn't really want Obama to become president, but he didn't really get into it. And but I want you to hear why he thought that Barack Obama was so dangerous. So get close to your radio and listen.
And so this is not something new. Why did I think it was an issue at that time? Because of a number of things. Let me give you just a few that I wrote about then and was worried about then, because of the philosophy of cultural Marxism and because of this man's long history with cultural Marxism. Not only from his university days, but even his church. This man sat under an overt Marxist pastor for decades. Jeremiah Wright was an overt, he was not just a cultural Marxist, he was also a classical Marxist, okay? This man had sat under that teaching for years and years. Not only had he done that, but his position on certain issues, like, for example, his homosexual agenda, the most radically pro-homosexual politician that I had ever seen or experienced in the mainstream, his position on abortion and infanticide, which was radical, on judicial activism, hate crimes legislation. And I believed and said openly on a number of occasions that I believed this man's presidency would make race relations in America worse, not better. An article that I wrote and actually reprinted 2 years later, because I'm not big on I told you so, but I told you so. And so, yes, this is, I don't think that I've come here this weekend suddenly talking about cultural Marxism because, you know, now it's a trump card that can be used in this particular debate. Nearly a decade and a half now, I've been addressing this issue. So with that in mind, let's look at it. A couple of things. First, cultural Marxism and classical Marxism are two different things. And this is one of the things that makes the discussion difficult. Classical Marxism, Karl Marx was an economist, right? I mean, classical Marxism is an economic system. You know, we know about the bourgeois and the proletariat. We know from each according to his ability, to each according to his need. We know about the uprising of the masses. We, you know, to overthrow capitalism. We know that Marx was a communist who wanted to see capitalism overthrown. He saw capitalism as oppressing the masses. He also saw religion as the opiate of the masses that allowed them to be oppressed by capitalism. So he was rabidly atheistic. And this is one of the things that makes it difficult to talk to people about cultural Marxism, right? Because classical Marxism is something that for most Christians, for most evangelicals, for real Christians, for real evangelicals who are not way out there on the fringe somewhere, just wouldn't identify with Marxism. And if we don't understand the difference between classical Marxism, this economic system, and cultural Marxism, which is very different than this and its approach, then if you just hear the word, it's like, how can you say that? How can you suggest that? Three main ideas. Let me give you this just to understand Marx, a summary of his salient points. Number one, he believed that history had really three stages or epochs. Number one, the ancient stage. Secondly, the feudal stage. And thirdly, the capitalist stage. He believed that he was witnessing the rise and would see eventually the fall of the capitalist stage. The second idea was the idea of class consciousness, that each one of these societal epochs contained internal contradictions. And these internal contradictions is what would lead to struggle and would eventually lead to the next phase, which led to the third idea, his idea of historical determinism, that ultimately capitalism would fall. Capitalism had to fall. Why? Because the way he viewed history was a view of struggle, was a series of struggles, a series of conflicts. He was a disciple of Hegel. So this was sort of his dialectic, if you will. Thesis, antithesis, synthesis, right? So capitalism had to fall. Workers of the world would unite and there would be a revolution. And there was, right? But not everywhere. And so toward the end of his life, and then during the life of his followers, they tried to explain and understand why it is that capitalism didn't fall. I mean, if capitalism is exploitation of the masses, and if history is all about these conflicts, and if this conflict is going to come, and if the next thing that is going to come is a post-capitalist society, then why haven't we seen this? Enter the cultural Marxists with a couple of goals. Number one, to explain why the revolution didn't occur as Marx thought it would. Marx died in 1888, by the way. So now we get into the late 1800s, the early 1900s. We get into World War I. And there are a couple of players that you need to know if you're going to understand cultural Marxism. One is a guy by the name of Antonio Gramsci. Gramsci was an Italian Marxist. Another one is not an individual, but a group of individuals known as the Frankfurt School. Two ideas. One, Gramsci's idea of cultural hegemony. Listen to the way one sociologist puts it. Cultural hegemony refers to domination or rule maintained through ideological or cultural means. It is usually achieved through social institutions which allow those in power to strongly influence the values, norms, ideas, expectations, worldview, and behavior of the rest of society. A cultural hegemony. That's the power. By the way, this idea of cultural hegemony explains something. Have you ever wondered why women, who make up more than 50% of the population, are considered a minority? You ever wondered why? Because women are not seen as part of the cultural hegemony. The cultural hegemony is patriarchal. The cultural hegemony, for example, in our society is white, male, heterosexual, cisgendered, able-bodied, native-born Americans. You know who you are. And everybody who's not that is a minority. And everybody who's not that is a victim of the cultural hegemony established by those individuals. Which means that everybody who's not that is at war with that. And everybody who is that is privileged. And the more of those boxes you tick off, the more privileged you are. Shame. Listen to this. Gramsci developed the concept of cultural hegemony in an effort to explain why the worker-led revolution that Marx predicted in the previous century had not come to pass. Central to Marx's theory of capitalism was the belief that the destruction of this economic system was built into the system itself, since capitalism is premised on the exploitation of the working class by the ruling class. Why didn't it happen? Well, because we're not dealing with economics. We're dealing with culture. Marx missed this part. Or so Gramsci would argue. He missed this part. So the revolution that comes doesn't need to be an armed revolution or a revolution of force. It needs to be a hegemonic revolution. In other words, we need to change the cultural hegemony. We need to overturn the cultural hegemony. And how do you overturn the cultural hegemony? Couple of things. For Gramsci, control the robes of society. What are the robes of society? You know, the people who wear robes. Judges. Professors. Pastors. Politicians. Leverage those positions in order to educate and mobilize the masses against the hegemonic power. Use the educational system, the political system, the judicial system in order to overturn the cultural hegemony. Does that sound at all familiar? This is how you gain power. By the way, in the meantime, how do you gain political power? You gain political power by promising various groups of people that you will advocate for them. That's how you do it. That's why you can have so many white, male, heterosexual, cisgendered, able-bodied, native-born American politicians who present themselves as representatives of the people who are not any of those things. That's That's how cultural Marxism works. Well, there's another group of individuals. The Frankfurt School. Let me give you this quickly. The Frankfurt School refers to a collection of scholars. Collection of scholars in Frankfurt, Germany. These individuals who were known for developing critical theory and popularizing the dialectic method of learning by interrogating society's contradictions, and it's most closely associated with the work of a number of German philosophers during the early 20th century. They saw a couple of things that for them explained why the revolution didn't happen. And for them, part of it was the fact that people were receiving so much information through mass media. Remember, this is the early 20th century. Radio, you know, just coming around. TV, not so much. So people weren't necessarily associating and interacting with each other like they had been in the past, but were receiving information through things like newspapers and radios and so on and so forth. So one of the main goals of the Frankfurt School was to leverage these tools in order to bring about the change in the hegemonic power. Reduce everything to discussions of race, class, gender, sex. And notice I use both of those because sex and gender are two different things, right? Sex has to do with your biology, gender, social construct. Your gender doesn't necessarily have to match your sex. Are we aware of this? And if your gender doesn't match your sex, then you are transgender as opposed to cisgender. For those of you who are wondering what that was, cisgender. Cisgender just means that you're not special. The Frankfurt School was concerned with mass media and the mass media culture. Saw people becoming passive recipients of political and ideological information instead of being activists. And they believed that this explained why the revolution didn't take place. They theorized that this experience made people intellectually inactive and politically passive as they allowed mass-produced ideologies and values to wash over them and to infiltrate their consciousness. Because of what happened in World War I, they left Germany. And in 1933, they went to Switzerland, but they only stayed there for a couple of years. And in 1935, they came to New York and became affiliated with Columbia University. There's a man by the name of Blint Vazonia, I probably didn't say his name correctly. He came to the United States fleeing the Nazis in Eastern Europe, fleeing the Nazis in Hungary, and he wrote a book called America's 30 Years War. And essentially his thesis was this. He ran away from what was happening in Europe by force, only to come to the United States and watch it happen gradually over the course of a generation. So, what do these guys give us? A number of things. Namely, critical theory. Have you heard the idea of critical race theory? It's a grandchild of the Frankfurt School. Political correctness. Multiculturalism. Any of these things sound familiar? So as a result of these ideologies, we have all been taught over time, through our media, through our educational systems, to view ourselves not as part of a whole, but as part of subgroups. As part of subgroups who, in some way, shape, fashion, or form, are being oppressed by the hegemonic power that rules and governs our culture. And so even when we talk about elections, we don't talk about this person is ahead in the polls by this much, that person is it. No, this person is ahead with red-headed, left-handed white people from the South, while this person is getting the vote of second-generation migrant workers with eczema. Why do we talk like that? Why do we think about politics that way? Why do we think about each other that way? Why do ideas like intersectionality from Kimberly Crenshaw in 1989 gain such popularity that people use it like we know what it is? By the way, if you don't know what intersectionality is, just what's the hegemonic power? White, male, heterosexual, cisgendered, able-bodied, native-born American people. That's the man, right? You ever heard that saying, you know, the man keeping us down? That's the man. And by the way, the list could go on and on and on. Intersectionality, in a nutshell, basically is the idea that to the degree that you don't have those things, you are oppressed. And so if you are male, heterosexual, cisgendered, right, native-born, American, able-bodied, by the way, also attractive, there's pretty privilege too, by the way. If you are all those things, but you're not white, right, then your oppression is limited to this area. But what if you're not white, but you're also not male? Now, that place where your not whiteness and your not maleness intersects is where you feel the weight of the oppression. But what if you're not white and not male and not heterosexual? Well, now the oppression is even worse on you because you have these three intersections of oppression. What if you're not white, not male, not heterosexual, and not cisgendered? Ooh. So now you are a black, trans male, lesbian. Anyway, you're... Now there are four intersections of oppression, right? Well, if you're not white and you're not male and you're not heterosexual and you're not cisgendered and you're not able-bodied, or you're not a native-born American, you're an immigrant, or you're not a... You see, intersectionality says that the level of oppression and the kind of oppression that you experience combines itself in these areas and layers itself in these areas, these intersections, if you will. But what is that if not a grown-up expression of cultural Marxism? By the way, when people use the term racism today, the term racism, you got to be careful and you got to understand what people are talking about. Because when people say racism, they could mean you are being accused of being an individual who has racist, prejudicial ideas toward other individuals. Or they could just be saying that you are a person who is part of the cultural hegemony, which, by the way, is inherently racist against people who are not white, male, heterosexual.
All right, we're going to stop the tape right there today. Wow, it's getting good. But we'll pick right back up there tomorrow. And that was Dr. Jody Bauckham, and he was talking about culture. Marxism. All right, that's it for today. Thank you for joining us. Listen to us all day long because we're in your corner right here on Ghostbusters.